The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 154, a paper entitled The LDS Church and Conflict Resolution, a Comparison Study with Other Faiths by Becky Johns, and a paper by Stephen Epperson, Religion and the War on Drugs.
Question of the Sunstone. We may be minus maybe one presenter today. I'm not sure yet. We'll wait and see if he shows up. We're going to go ahead and let the presenters take at least maybe a half hour, if they so desire, to make their presentation. If we're short the last person that was going to make comments, then I'm sure there'll be plenty of time for questions and answers after. But we'll see. We've still got some coming in, so we'll take a look at who comes in. We have Becky Johns, who's a PhD candidate in communications from the University of Utah. She'll be our first presenter, and then we'll be followed by Stephen Epperson, program coordinator for the Utah Humanities Council. Do we have Jeff Silliman here? Oh, okay, fine. Jeff Silliman is a senior pastor of the Mount Olympus Presbyterian Church, and he will follow the presenters then with his comments, and then we'll pick up from there if there's time and questions. We'll go ahead and follow on there. They'd like us to remind anyone, if you haven't picked up a ticket, to please pick up a ticket for this particular session, and also they would really like you to fill out the questionnaires that are out there so they can use that for their statistical work that they're doing. So we'll turn it over to Becky Johns then. You want the lights out? You tell me when.
Yeah, not for a bit here. Good afternoon, and I'm pleased to be with you today. And I have to apologize to Mr. Silliman because the draft that he probably has of this paper is significantly different from this, because the one I sent to the Sunstone Symposium about 7 weeks ago has gone through a bit of a change. So excuse me, and hopefully it will have some bearing on what you've prepared. Let me introduce myself just a little bit, and then I would really welcome your comments and questions at the appropriate time in the session. It's a work in progress, so I definitely would like to have your comments and questions and your input into this interesting area of religious studies. I'm an active LDS member. I live in Ogden and teach at Weber State University. My particular area of research is in communication, organizational communication. Particular emphasis is religious organizations. So I've been involved in looking at a variety of faiths and their organizational makeup for some time, including the LDS faith. This is the first time I've had an opportunity to explore conflict and conflict resolution methods. And I was fairly naive as I began this project, thinking that this would make a nice session and I'd be able to do this in a short amount of time, and find out that it's a huge, huge area of consideration, and I am only just beginning to get to the surface of this topic. So I was quite naive in thinking that this would be an appropriate size topic for one session. I teach in the area of communication, and so a lot of what I'm going to be presenting today is from my area of teaching, which has to do with organizational communication. And you'll see as I go through the paper itself how that gets played out in my analysis. Conflict is no stranger in religion. Wars, purges, cleansings, trials, inquisitions, witch hunts, these are all common outgrowths of religious conflict. And perhaps there is no other place in human life as filled with conflict and its aftermath as religion. For the purposes of this study, what do I mean by conflict? Linda Putnam and Marshall Scott Poole suggest that conflict is, quote, the interaction of interdependent people who perceive opposition of goals, aims, and values, and who see the other party as potentially interfering with the realization of these goals, unquote. In other words, conflict exists only when people or groups who are entwined with one another express the perception that the other party may stand in the way of some important aim. Three key concepts here are that the parties must be interdependent. They must need each other or work with each other or compete in the same supply and demand markets or in some way be significant to each other. In other words, you cannot have a conflict with someone you don't care about. You can have a disagreement with someone you don't care about, but a conflict in the way that I'm describing it can only happen with people that are important to you and to your organization. For conflict to exist, there also needs to be expression of it. Although, of course, there is such a thing as latent conflict, and we've all felt the tension of that, but we don't really know what it is and that it really exists until it is expressed somehow. And the third key concept is the idea of incompatible goals. Values, beliefs, ideas, and attitudes are deeply embedded in this idea of incompatible goals. And their realization can apparently only happen when another party's goals are not met. Thus, we have conflict. Most of the ways that that Northern Americans perceive conflict has to do with winning and losing, with one person being on top and all the others being on the bottom. We'll talk in a few minutes about how that comes into play when we discuss conflict in religion. Some researchers have specifically examined intergroup conflict, whites against blacks, men against women, Nazis against Jews. These types of intergroup conflict are associated with, quote, differences between social groups, which form the basis of the conflict. So-called natural or traditional differences in the characteristics of the group appear to make conflict inevitable to some. In other words, it's normal, it's traditional, because the two groups are so different. In addition, the ideas of a clear winner and loser and in-group and out-group behavior appear to be important action motivators in intergroup conflict. I believe these concepts of interpersonal and intergroup conflict may be helpful in analyzing conflicts among and in religious faiths. A very brief contemporary overview of intergroup religious conflict, primarily in the United States, may be useful here, and I might note it's very brief. I should also note that when I use the term intergroup conflict, I'm referring to that conflict between religious faith organizations and their environment, the culture itself. Clearly, intra-group religious conflict is a significant topic and will be discussed in just a few moments. Let's begin with something positive, because most of this paper is not very positive. So let's start with something positive, ecumenism. Cooperative efforts of religious groups to respect and understand one another. It first appeared strongly in the 1960s, and is still seen today in a variety of various faiths. One example that I'd like to point to is, I think, a very encouraging example of ecumenism happened in 1997. A church-wide assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America accepted full communion with the Presbyterian Church, the Reformed Church in America, and the United Church of Christ. It also accepted a common statement on justification with Roman Catholics, which was quite a surprise. As promising as the ecumenical movement has been, conflict, however, has predominated the religious scene in the last few decades. Actually, it's predominated the religious scene for centuries, but we're only going to deal with the contemporary scene. About 20 years ago or so, we saw a significant development with a growing division between conservatives and liberals, which for the first time crossed the boundaries of organizations like religions. Conservative Protestants, fundamentalists, and Catholics were battling abortion, the Supreme Court ban on school prayer, and pornography, as well as a number of other issues. Liberal Protestants and Catholics found themselves on the same side with secular humanists on most issues, an uncomfortable place for both. The religious right and the moral majority were born, and religion continues to play a significant role in American politics. Donald C. Swift, in his book Religion and the American Experience, suggests that, quote, there is no evidence that the yawning gap separating religious liberals and conservatives will soon be bridged. It involves a cultural war to define what America should be, unquote. I don't suspect that the division between liberals and conservatives will go away. I think, in fact, that it probably will widen, as we'll see here in a few minutes from my analysis, and that will cause even greater amounts of conflict. Other big issues in which religious groups have clashed significantly include the rights of women and homosexuals, and then the births of sects, cults, and non-Western religions and their often extreme behaviors. These things have generally been taken care of in other places, so I'm not going to comment too much on them now. Let's turn our attention to the LDS Church for a moment and its struggles with the culture at large and with other religious organizations. Missionary efforts are a highly visible area of conflict. Clashes with already established religions and cultures have long been a challenge for the LDS missionary program. The specific conflicts and issues deriving therefrom have been analyzed elsewhere, but nationalism, the existence of native religions, entrenched Roman Catholicism, state anti-church sentiments, and extreme political agendas have resulted in harassment, bombings, and even missionary assassinations. The modern Mormon Church's emphasis on temple building and providing LDS meeting houses in every community of saints has also significantly contributed to conflict. Land, like religion, has been a traditional arena of conflict for many centuries. Theocracy, or political government highly influenced by religion or religious leaders, is a controversial issue in Utah, at least. Conflict about the amount of influence the LDS Church wields in decisions made in this state is a regular occurrence, and for many, the impact of the Mormon Church in state affairs is inarguable. For some community and church leaders, the LDS Church's stated opposition to homosexuals, feminists, liberals, and intellectuals is a growing conflict. Some commentators have suggested that modern heresy trials have taken place around these issues, and members have been disciplined, including being excommunicated, for violations of ambiguous church policy. It's interesting to note at this point what is not an issue of conflict presently with the LDS Church. For instance, outside of church members, there's little doctrinal conflict, even inside with church members, there's little doctrinal conflict, unless perhaps it is the meaning of the appellation Christian, and whether or not certain groups of non-Mormons should be baptized after death by proxy in LDS temples. The LDS Church has made a concerted effort to fit into the mainstream of religious life and produce an image of amenability, if not bendability, regarding doctrinal differences. Again, these issues need little explanation as they've been dealt with sufficiently elsewhere. I also find it interesting to note that the LDS Church's social action policies, especially in regard to financing the defeat of the legalization of homosexual marriages, garners very little attention. The Mormon Church is not known for a great deal of social action, and most of that being agitation for negatives, such as against the ERA, against pornography, against homosexual-friendly legislation. Many other churches are at the center of human issues regarding their members, like housing, poverty, human rights violations, race and gender imbalances. I also find very little conflict in or about the LDS Church regarding its vast real estate holdings, investments in financial worth and policies. I believe other religious organizations, like many marriages, fight a great deal about money, but the LDS Church does not. Before I discuss particular conflict resolution patterns, I need to say a few words about interpersonal conflict. That is, conflict within a church because its members disagree with one another or with specific church leaders. Conflict is often personal. Joseph Smith's life is replete with a number of interpersonal conflicts. These conflicts were not always doctrinal. Many were about marital issues in his relationship with Emma, and some of the most difficult situations in his life were with his faithful followers. This is not difficult to believe because all of us are subject to interpersonal conflict. It's normal, inevitable, and when managed correctly, it's beneficial to the relationships in our lives. One of my biggest concerns as I teach the youth of Utah of college age is that they rarely contradict what I have to say. Even though sometimes I purposefully say things that I don't believe, that I think, well, that they should or that they will contradict me. Rather, they eschew conflict completely because I am the teacher, an authority figure. And if they know anything, They know that faithful Mormons do not challenge authority. This is unfortunate for all of us because conflict can be good for individuals and relationships. Julia T. Wood, a communication theorist, makes this point when she says, although we tend to think of conflict negatively, conflict can help us grow as individuals and strengthen our relationships. We can enlarge our perspectives when we engage in conflicts that propel personal growth and learning. We deepen insight into our ideas and feelings when we have to express them and consider critical responses. Sometimes this supports our own identity by clarifying how we differ from others, unquote. I even suggest to my students that conflict can be good for their sex lives as well, because studies show that partners who argue have livelier sex lives. They still don't contradict what I have to say. I characterize the kind of conflict style of my students as a loyalty or neglect response. Now let me explain what I mean. A series of studies identified four distinct ways North Americans respond to relational distress. And I have an overhead to sort of show you how this works. According to this model, responses can be either active or passive, depending on how emphatically they address problems. Responses can also be constructive or destructive in their capacity to resolve tension and to preserve relationships. Exit, in the far up left corner, refers to physical or psychological withdrawal. A member may become inactive or remove herself from the church records or may simply exit certain relationships where conflict is evident. The neglect response, the lower left, occurs when an individual denies or minimizes problems, disagreements, anger, tension, or other matters that could lead to overt conflict. A church member may suggest that another is making a mountain out of a molehill, or that a problem is being created when really none exists. The loyalty response, the lower right, is staying committed to the relationship despite differences. Loyalty involves deference in order to sustain the relationship, and anger, resentment, disagreement may be felt but never expressed. The loyal church member is one who may feel angry and resentful at times, but does not express it to anyone in power positions of these concerns. The voice response, the upper right quadrant, is an active, constructive strategy for dealing with conflict by talking about problems and trying to resolve them. It's constructive and active in that it's the most preferred strategy that is taught in interpersonal relationship building. The church member who uses the voice strategy asks questions, expresses doubts, debates those in positions of power when critical issues are at stake. How many of you know such people in the LDS Church? There aren't too many of them. In order to determine the personal conflict resolution style used by people of differing faiths, I administered a personal conflict style questionnaire based on a Blake and Mouton instrument to more than 100 LDS students at Weber State University and interviewed a number of individuals who have membership in Jewish, Catholic, Church of Christ, Southern Baptist, Lutheran, and Buddhist church organizations. And not nearly enough of those people. I'm not suggesting that I've done a tremendous amount of data collection yet. I would like to do more. It's really been quite interesting. My findings suggest that LDS conflict resolution styles pertaining to conflict issues with other LDS members or church leaders are more often than not loyalty, neglect, and exit, in that order. Loyalty being the number one most self-reported conflict resolution style, then neglect, and then exit. Voice is a personal conflict style not often utilized in the personal relationships of Latter-day Saints. My interview suggests that the LDS Church stands almost alone in the preferences for these styles. Of the non-LDS religious persons I spoke with, all but one suggested that voice is the preferred conflict resolution style between members and authorities in their church or religion. As an example, I spoke with several Southern Baptist adherents who complain that perhaps there is too much voice in their particular congregation. Recently, their local placed an old lighting system in its chapel, and many hours were spent by the entire congregation in arguing about what kind, what type, and what intensity the prospective lights should be. The prospect of such a debate with an entire LDS congregation is absolutely unheard of in the modern Mormon church. Even in the Roman Catholic Church sample, an organization very hierarchical and patriarchal as the LDS Church is, voice was reported by all respondents as the preferred conflict resolution style. More research needs to be done to validate these findings, but the direction that they are going at this point should be of concern to LDS members. Next, I utilized a class project in my organizational communication classes, and I was able to conduct another investigation into the perceived conflict resolution management styles of a variety of faiths. We developed a tool, which was a questionnaire, so another self-report mechanism, to determine overall leader conflict resolution style based on Likert's System Theory 1 through 4. We'll look at this in just a minute. Likert is the founder and longtime director of the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. And any of you who have taken an attitudinal scale from 1 to 5 or 1 to 7, and 1 being almost never and 7 being always, you're taking a Likert scale, which is the same researcher. Likert theorizes that there are a number of forms that an organization can take, and that these forms are more or less effective in satisfying organizational and individual goals, including the resolution of conflict. Likert identifies 4 systems and suggests that they are easily differentiated on characteristics of motivation, communication styles, decision-making, goal-setting, control, influence structure, and performance. And let me show you an overhead of that. Likert System 1, the exploitive authoritative organization, is characterized by motivation through threats and fear, downward and inaccurate communication, top-level decision-making, the giving of orders, and top-level control. Likert System 2 is called the benevolent authoritative organization. This organizational type is characterized by motivation through economic and ego rewards, limited communication, decision-making at the top, goal-setting through orders and comments, and top-level control. It is in many ways similar to a System 1 organization, but does not incorporate the explicit goal of exploiting organizational members. However, the conflict resolution style in this organization is still very authoritative, as the leaders believe that this is best for the members. System 3, the consultative organization, differs markedly from the System 1 and System 2. In this organizational type, decisions are still made at the top, and control still rests primarily at the upper levels of the hierarchy. However, before decisions are made, organizational members are consulted and their views are taken into consideration. Goals and conflict resolutions are set after discussion, and there is a high level of communication moving both up and down the hierarchy. Finally, a participative organization, System 4, provides a sharp contrast to the other system types. In a System 4 organization, decision-making is performed by every organizational member, and goals are set by complete member groups. Control is exercised at all levels of the organization, and communication is extensive, including upward, downward, and horizontal interaction. The contributions of all organizational members are strongly valued, and members are rewarded through the satisfaction of a wide variety of their needs. Of the 4 types, System 4 is more highly regarded because of its humanness, but also because of its effectiveness. Our group surveyed members of the Church of Christ, a Jewish synagogue, a Buddhist temple, a Catholic parish, a fundamentalist Mormon community, and a Southern Baptist congregation, as well as a number of mainstream Mormon members. According to our questionnaire results, 1 faith group was categorized as System 4, that is, participative organization. That was the Jewish synagogue. And 1 group was categorized as a System 2, benevolent authoritative organization, and that was the mainstream Mormon church. And all others were categorized into the System 3, consultative organization. If Likert's system is valid in this comparison, a review of the perceived conflict resolution methods used by leaders of the LDS Church suggests that fear and punishment is a continuing pattern, with some reward strategies being used. There perhaps is little communication between members and leaders, and what there is very task-oriented and downward in direction. Decision-making is done only at the upper levels, where conflict resolution patterns are also patterned for members as ways of dealing with decisions regarding conflict in their interpersonal lives. Participation is only fair, and leaving the church or becoming inactive is high. And I've given you a kind of across the fair what that would look like. What conclusions could be drawn from this work? Well, first of all, much more study needs to be done, and more samples need to be taken. And I would like to add to the research by doing participative and non-participative observation, as all of the data so far has been self-report. So we need to do much more in terms of understanding the problem. Secondly, as a church, we should be concerned with the climate of the System 2 conflict resolution style and the loyalty personal conflict style of Mormons. I'm not suggesting that the way the church's leadership or membership resolves conflict is people. It may not be meeting the needs of its members and utilizing the full potential of everyone that is possible. I constantly encourage my students to find their voices, to express their concerns, and to engage in meaningful dialectical dialogue, often with me and with other authority figures, to call us out, to call us down, to be confrontive. But unfortunately, I stand almost alone. We need more of such kind of encouragement. We need to develop a climate in the Mormon Church which supports honest and difficult questioning and honors a variety of ways of dealing with conflict. Thank you.
This is the work in progress session. I really appreciated what Becky presented. I think it was very, very interesting, Becky, and I know that a lot of us have lots of questions and ways we want to respond to your observations and the data that you presented. My work also, by way of disclaimer, and also to Reverend Silliman, is that this is also very much a work in progress, an issue about which I've not, until recently, given a great deal of thought, even though I've been reading about it, like most of you, for years in the media. That is, I'm talking about, you know, drugs, drug use, drug war in this country. I've been reading but not thinking, I think, a predicament that's shared by many of us who are overwhelmed by info glut. In order to act the part of responsible citizens and as intellectuals, we frequently believe that we need to be really well informed about affairs in our nation and our society. But when we tune in, we get overwhelmed by an unending barrage of information. And the result is we get paralyzed, I think, by the sheer quantity and by the complexity of the information that comes to us. And the scale of problems like drug use, drug issues, drug war is really overwhelming. So frequently, I think my strategy for coping has been to just end up transferring the solution to others, to experts, to policymakers. Recently, however, I was asked to participate on a panel discussion about the ethics of the war on drugs, and it prodded me to think and to make a stand about it, on it, something I had not done in the past. Something else I want to say by way of like a preliminary observation, and that is Now, I'm not an expert at all on public policy with regard to drug use and efforts to combat drug use in this country. However, I think that any kind of examination of the history of the war on the narcotics industry and of drug consumption in this country reveals that it has fallen far short of its variously stated goals. That is, efforts to interdict the flow of drugs into this country or the manufacture of illicit drugs in this country. The attempt to eliminate production and consumption of illegal drugs in the United States have failed, and they will continue to fail. No amount of drug money, war rhetoric, and public mobilization will end the production and consumption of illicit narcotics in this nation. We're spending nearly $30 billion a year now, and even the, you know, Mr. McCaffrey, the drug czar, is pretty much talking about the futility of interdicting drugs coming into this country from abroad. The war on drugs has, ironically, also created very serious negative effects that were unanticipated by its authors. Those include widespread corruption and militarization of drug-exporting countries, and also of the domestic subcultures of illegal drug consumption in the United States. It has led to serious erosion of standards in American law enforcement, in prisons, and in the judiciary. Reports of civil rights abuses abound, and the rates of incarceration, especially among racial minorities and the working poor, explode, even though the overall crime rate in this nation is dropping dramatically. So those are just some preliminaries. In terms of preliminary observations, has to do with some thoughts about religious and theological responses to drug use. In numerous cultures, the use of drugs of various sorts has been and continues to be socially acceptable and has been incorporated in traditions, values, and practices of a variety of societies. In this country and many countries, I'm talking about alcohol and tobacco consumption. In the Andes and in southern Asia and Africa, you know, the widespread use of chewing on coca and betel leaves, the use of kava in southern Pacific islands as a means of conviviality and also in religious gatherings. In addition, so we've got, you know, this aspect of socially acceptable uses of certain kinds of narcotics and drugs. In addition, there are religious traditions in which the use of psychedelic drugs has been a central feature of worship and experience. And those fall roughly into two different categories. One is for the purpose of divination. That is, a shaman, individual, will take a psychedelic drug to induce a certain kind of state which enables him or her to find lost objects or people, to obtain advice on personal and tribal problems from the world of spirits, and for revealing a diagnosis and cure for certain kinds of diseases. A second purpose of, you know, the use of psychedelic drugs has been for the experience of transcendence, of unification of one's immediate and limited experience. And in the case I'm thinking particularly of the peyote cult of the Native American church, where the focus, where the intent is unification with one's own experience with that of the great, you know, the experience reality of the Great Spirit, in hopes of incorporating that Spirit's power and of receiving revealed truth on how to live rightly. These cases disclose that education, culture, and social consensus can contribute directly to shaping positive attitudes, practices, and experiences with respect to certain kinds of drug use. It's clear, however, with few exceptions, that monotheistic religions of the West have vigorously opposed the use of psychedelic and other psychoactive drugs due to several certain kinds of insights. I think the first and perhaps the most important, at least historically, has been that the use of drugs has entailed an unacceptable recognition and veneration of alternative altars, that is, of gods, spirits, and of traditions that are alien to those worshipped, you know, by those who focus their devotion to the singular and jealous God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Just a few examples. Historically, in 391, the Emperor Theodosius closed all pagan temples and forbade all non-Christian worship and rituals, including that of the oracle at Delphi, the most venerable of all ancient sacred sites in the ancient classical world, where the priestess of Apollo reportedly inhaled intoxicating vapors and then prophesied by the inspiration of Apollo. Spanish conquistadors persecuted cults of peyote and mushroom eating in Central and Southern America, in focusing on the extirpation of pre-Columbian religions, to the degree that that use by those religions was largely forgotten by most inhabitants of the region. And then closer to home, the temperance movement in America, we had with the temperance movement a crusade waged for over a century, which really constituted this nation's first war on drugs. That the purpose of its campaign was to prohibit the manufacture, sale, and of alcoholic beverages. Interestingly, it was as much, for those who study American religious history, American religious sociology, it was as much an Anglo-Protestant assault on the immigrant culture of American Catholics, be they German, Hispanic, or Irish, as it was a public health crusade. For a long time, Roman Catholicism in this country was perceived as, by Protestant communities, as, having a sort of a twinge of kind of the pagan and of the idolatrous, especially with, the veneration of saints and of Mary. So from the perspective of religious ethics, drug use has been opposed for not enhancing individual human autonomy. The subculture of drug use and of drug-induced states combine to weaken the rational will of the user and to make him or her increasingly prey to powerful and irrational emotional and physical states of need and of craving. Rather than promoting the formation of a rational, ethical, and autonomous adult, the subculture of drug use and of drug-induced states render the drug user dependent upon synthetic substances alien to the individual. They induce a false consciousness and reduce the user to dependency on a social network of marketing and of coercion that sees the user as merely a consumer, not a full person. In fact, I'm quite interested when teenage children who were faced with issues about drugs, drug use, drug culture. I was surprised in many ways at the reason for my kind of adamant, an animated rejection and disapproval of it had a lot to do with the violence that is really part and parcel of the drug, the illicit drug industry today. One or two steps at most away from the friendly young person, maybe at high school, who's trying to sell a nickel bag of marijuana, is someone with a cell phone and a gun. So it's become very, very dangerous. It's not we're not in the loved generation anymore when it comes to the drug subculture, at least a few steps away. So I think that's also definitely a reason why we should take alarm at that subculture. So the sum of the reduction of autonomy produced by the setting, use of, and experience of narcotics is that the user is neither transported to a permanently higher level of awareness nor enabled to better produce the real fruits of their religious life. Finally, religious communities and the families that comprise them are properly concerned with the adverse health and social effects of illegal drug use. In view of these concerns, the opposition by religious communities to illicit drug use and abuse may be construed as being consistent with belief and reason about what they perceive as helpful to the spiritual, secular, personal, and social well-being of both the individual and of the community. Having said that, however, I believe that our religious communities must begin to rationally and prophetically reassess their tacit and/or overt support of this nation's generation-long war against drug use. For there is a significant difference between opposing drug use on spiritual and ethical grounds and of uncritically supporting a failed public policy. The war on drugs is racist, it's biased against class, it's contemptuous of basic civil rights. It annually wastes billions of tax dollars. It's corrupting our policing, penal, and judicial systems. It is used by political parties to perpetuate deep divisions in this nation and to dodge our common responsibility to ensure adequate health, housing, and education for all of our citizens. In sum, I believe that the war on drugs is a catastrophic moral problem, a scandal, and that religious communities, which wield extraordinary, if diffuse power in this nation, could and should be using it to call this nation and its leaders to their senses. The war on drugs has been an abject failure. It's time to seek a rational, compassionate, and peaceful conclusion to this, our longest war. Why religious communities are not coming forward raises vexing questions that are central to what I think religion is all about. What I fear is that institutional religions in this country have accommodated to the practices and assumptions of secular culture so profoundly that they cannot meet the deep spiritual hunger of millions of people who are looking for meaningful and abiding ways to fully appreciate and to experience what Abraham Heschel called, quote, the inner life, the splendor of thought, the dignity of wonder and reverence. In addition, I think that the silence of religion on the war on drugs underlines that contemporary American religious organizations are abdicating an essential prophetic responsibility to establish the kingdom of God and its justice. Let me be frank about this. An important reason for the allure of narcotics is their delivery of enhanced and altered states of mind and body. Okay? That's why that's one of the big reasons why people are going to use them. Something happens. The experience may be fleeting, it may be transient, but it's experienced as real and intense. Mundane reality gives way momentarily to a deeper and wider life. And isn't that precisely what gnaws inside many of us? What the American philosopher Bruce Wilshire calls a wild hunger, an emptiness left by the loss of ecstatic kinship with which our species once enjoyed with nature. Developmental physiologists postulate that the brain, that the human brain, as it evolved in our pre-human and human ancestors, generated natural opiates needed for survival in the wilderness. These opiates, endomorphins and analgesics, were released naturally and periodically to meet the demands of our living in nature. The history of human beings with urban industrial society and cultures is a mere blink of an eye in comparison to the great expanse of time and development of our species. Our bodies, Bruce Wilshire writes, still cycle in ancient rhythms of the demanding and supporting nature that formed us, though we try to beat them down with round-the-clock labor, shopping, broadcasting, and with non-stimulating repetitive labor and social routines. Absent are the strenuous efforts to cultivate the mind, body, and soul. Absent are significant public practices that acknowledge and prepare us for the transitions of nature and for the changes that take place in our own bodies. The result is addictive cravings and of behaviors that try to fill that void, an impersonal affair and institutional loyalty. It survives on the level of activities rather than on the stillness of commitment. Its chief virtue is social affiliation rather than conviction, end quote. Jewish theologian and philosopher Arthur Green has stated that spirituality as an essential value in religious traditions is a striving for the presence of God and for fashioning a life of holiness appropriate to such striving. Ways of living in holiness can include an appreciation and cultivation of enhanced individual states of consciousness. But spirituality then also reaches out from the individual. It calls for a sense, again, this is Arthur Green's words, it calls for a sense of responsibility in the realm of human affairs, of compassion for the oppressed and poor, and the willingness to serve as a peacemaker within the human community, end quote. And I think it's precisely these attributes of spirituality, enhanced states of consciousness, rational, responsible action, compassion for the oppressed, and peacemaking within the community that are lacking in the contemporary struggle against the distribution and use of illegal narcotics. Religious lay people and leaders should ask themselves, What happens to the spiritual practices of a religious tradition when a faith community uncritically supports warlike and punitive measures and rhetoric? What does it mean when there is essentially no difference between the discourse of secular public policymakers and of religious leaders? What kind of message do they believe this communicates to young men and women who need the emptiness in their hearts filled with an educated sense of wonder, awe, and commitment? Who need adult and public and efficacious examples of spirituality and compassion that gets expressed not only over the pulpit or extended to the members of the community of the faithful, but to the faithless, to the other, to the enemy as well. To return specifically to the war on drugs, if it's failed to achieve its objectives and has instead resulted in the immiseration and militarization of foreign nations and of our own inner cities, if it has eroded civil rights, if it's filled our jails and prisons beyond capacity, and this nation has 500,000 more people in jails than the People's Republic of China, we incarcerate more people in this country than any other nation on the earth, and we spend up to $30,000 to imprison one individual when we're spending, $4,000 to educate our young people. It's the least cost-efficient way to punish and to rehabilitate those who infract on the law. If this war has defunded proven social and therapeutic programs for drug treatment, and it has at an alarming rate, if it's debased our civic identity by pandering to prejudice and coarsening our civic discourse by flooding it with shrill crusading rhetoric, then why have religious communities and their leaders done so little to critique and to resist this failed, protracted struggle? I've already cited the reasons for opposition to drug abuse from the perspective of Western religions. They oppose alternative altars, and also oppose the failure of drugs to deliver the goods, that is, a sustained higher level of a religious awareness and action. It's also had the negative and destructive effects on mind, body, and relations. Still, I think there's something missing. These reasons do not adequately explain the failure of communities of faith to resist the lure of war rhetoric and a warlike, punitive outlook and behavior. The aim of the religious life is to raise the level of being of its practitioner, to enable him and her to vividly feel part of a wider life and to vigorously affirm the existence of a transcendent power. The effect of these experiences should lift the center of the emotions from the individual ego outward towards a passionate commitment to others. This, I believe, is where religions are failing to provide, what religions are failing to provide to those who want their religious traditions to act publicly in ways that are congruent with a sustained and deep inner spiritual life. The roots of our current failures go back over 40 years. In the midst of a religious revival in the 1950s, the churches, church historian Sidney Ahlstrom quipped, the churches muffed their chance. With new multitudes entering their portals, religions failed to sustain human religious needs. The churches, by and large, seem to have done little more than to provide a means of social identification to a mobile people who were being rapidly cut loose from the comfort of old contexts. I mean, in the 1950s, people were moving a great deal out of old neighborhoods and into suburbs. The result of sacrificing theological and spiritual substance in the 50s was that clergy and laity alike were left demoralized and confused by the harsh social and spiritual realities of the 1960s. Calls for austerity, personal austerity and simplicity, calls for the cultivation of a deeper awareness of the reality of the divine, and calls for a truer and more effective love for all mankind and the natural world went largely unheeded. Instead, focus was placed on church building, programs and institutional building and socializing. Instead, public rhetoric, pulpit rhetoric, when it takes up this theme, takes up the theme of drug abuse, focuses on drug abuse as an individual character flaw or the product of a degenerate alien outside culture. It then invokes the therapeutics of repentance and of divine grace, but for good measure appeals to the coercive powers of the state to place our children beyond harm's way by intensifying the war effort. This tactic reminds me of the perennial calls for the return of prayer in schools and of the Ten Commandments to be posted on walls of, you know, courthouses and schools, and also what seems really peculiar to me in Utah of lots of people turning to junior highs and high schools as the site for religious instruction in, you know, religious instruction in choral music. I mean, think about our ward choirs. Okay, think about the level of musicianship in our communities and our churches. And I think what's a scandal that is we turn to the public schools to do the instruction in you know, religious music and singing, and we get catastrophes like what happened at West High School. When faith communities appropriate the war rhetoric of lobbyists, legislators, and administrators, they fail to articulate the qualities of rational action and compassion for the oppressed and peacemaking within the community identified by Arthur Green as the public hallmarks of spirituality. Fixated by war, by sexual scandal, we neglect graver moral issues of social justice that call for adequate and affordable housing, meaningful employment, and equality before the law. By failing to respond to these needs and to the needs of those who have an awareness of the presence of that power that religions call God, faith communities contribute to the very conditions which give rise to the culture of drugs. I just have a couple more points I want to make. Well, sort of sketching out this kind of, negative field, what do you do? If that is indeed the case, if our rhetoric, if public rhetoric on the part of the churches, church elites, haven't really addressed the issues, about the failure of the war on drugs and haven't adequately addressed the issue of the thirst that people have for transcendent experiences, then what do they do? What should religions and religious, what should lay people and what should religious leaders do? I just want to just suggest four things very quickly. First of all, I think that religious organizations should exercise the kind of courage that the Salt Lake Tribune recently did by declaring that the war on drugs is a failure. It's a failure on the level of public policy and failure as a moral and ethical response to very, very vexing psychological, social, and economic issues. Second, I think that churches should call for a rational investigation and response to addiction. There are proven and effective clinical treatments to drug use and drug abuse. That have been used in other countries and one time for a very short period in the early 1970s in this nation. We need to be addressing, the effectiveness of those therapeutic and clinical, responses and options. Third, I think that we need again to turn to the good book and turn to the example of Jesus of Nazareth and of his ethic of hospitality. He surrounded himself with people who were sort of socially marginal folks and outcasts. He was criticized vociferously by others for the fact that he, hung out with tax collectors and adulterers and wine bibbers, drinkers. So we should be thinking about, using that example of extending our efforts to embrace and not to demonize. And finally, I think that we really need to think seriously about spirituality, about the desperate need that we feel for experience of the transcendent. And there are varieties and ways in which we can address that, but it's not easy. I just want to end with one example, and hopefully you'll come up with others and help me out on this. As a young person growing up in this valley, say 13, 14, 15 years old, I think that the single most, and I remember it and I get goosebumps when I think about it to this day, the single most effective way of connecting my individual ego with a larger life was by going out on the western end of the valley with other ward members to hoe beets on our welfare farm. Now that might sound really odd, okay? But for some, for an idealistic young person who wanted to be connected to a larger life, here I was working in a multi-generational setting, you know, with grandparents, parents, and kids, setting aside occupational and class differences to do something for somebody else with no thought for self, but thinking about others. And that was, you know, the most powerful experience of in my life in terms of getting a glimpse of what Mormons want to call Zion and what Zion's all about, or what the kingdom of God is all about. But it's not easy. You know, that road to that path to transcendent experiences is a path of disciplined learning and experience. And I think that we are selling ourselves short and taking the easiest path, and instead relying on public policy, policymakers, our judiciary, and the police force to take care of the problem for us. Okay, so I really anticipate and welcome Reverend Silliman's responses and also your responses as well. Okay, thanks very much.
We were just trying to work out a game plan of how to handle the remaining time we have, which is about a little less than a half hour. It seems to me we've got roughly 15 minutes of response time for each one of the presentations. And, of course, I have 2 hours worth of... No, I don't. have 2 hours worth of response for each one. But what I thought I might do is respond, first of all, to Mr. Epperson's presentation. And then I would say that perhaps we ought to have... any questions or concerns which dealt with his presentation, maybe focus there, and then we'll go to Mr. John's presentation, and maybe we could deal with that instead of just going back and forth between the two of them. Would that be all right with everybody here? As far as Mr. Epperson's presentation goes, I have little to argue with there in terms of the concerns you have about the war on drugs. I think are well placed and seem to be. In my estimation, very persuasive. I can only speak as I'm a part of the Presbyterian Church USA, which is one of the so-called mainstream denominations in the United States, and I can only speak out of the experience of my own denomination. I'm not an expert at all on anything to do with drug culture and war on drugs as far as religious groups being involved in that. Our denomination has not taken a very active part in backing that particular effort. We have not done a lot of rhetoric saying, yeah, let's get those SOBs that are in using drugs and so on. We have historically, as a denomination, have spent much more time on social justice issues, trying to address the kinds of conditions which create despair, which often lead people to use drugs to anesthetize themselves to the tough situation they find themselves in life. And so we've addressed issues like housing and fair employment and minimum wage and migrant workers and all those kinds of things. We've addressed those things quite extensively. We maintain a Washington office as a denomination. We have several staff members who are in Washington to communicate our denomination's concerns to federal legislators, and we spend most of our time on that. I'm not aware that we spend a lot of time urging people to fight drugs more with more money and that sort of thing. The thing our denomination hasn't done a very good job of, but is recently turning around quite a bit, and that is to try to say it's not enough to simply address social issues and social justice matters, but we've also got to address this spirituality issue much more forthrightly. Your citation about, who was it?
Sidney Ahlstrom?
Sidney Ahlstrom, yeah, the church historian, about religion in the 50s. Yeah, I've talked to people who were pastors of Presbyterian churches in the 50s and say people were just, after World War II and Korea, people were simply flocking to churches. We had no idea why they were coming in. In fact, to get them, to keep them out, you'd have to probably stand on the doorstep with a ball bat and just beat them off. Their experience in the wars drove them to realize that life was a very finite thing, that their life was hanging in a balance while they're on the battlefield, and therefore they wanted to connect with a reality bigger than themselves, so they just flocked to churches when they got back to the U.S. and back to normal living. And somehow, those of us in religious groups somehow thought we were doing a good job. And that was the reason they were coming. Well, that really wasn't the reason they were coming. Our denomination, for example, started losing members in the 1960s, when that when that surge wore off. And we've been scratching our heads for nearly 35 years now trying to figure out what happened. And we've done study after study. And what we found is that we're actually not losing members any faster than we ever were before. People were getting disillusioned, dropping out. People were moving to some other town and becoming Lutherans or whatever. People were dying at about the same rate. People were getting mad at some position our church took and therefore leave the church at about the same rate they had been doing for decades and decades. The problem we were having is that people were not coming in the front door anymore. And we hadn't addressed that issue, and that gets back to not addressing the needs of people for spiritual connectedness and finding some contact with God in a meaningful way. And so we've recently begun emphasizing that much more. Some of us have been thinking we should have addressed that for 30 years. It's kind of depressing for me. I've been an ordained clergyman for 30 years. And all the 30 years of my ministry, we've been sinking downhill in terms of an institution. But the individual congregations are doing really quite well, and but as a whole, we're doing poorly. But anyway, getting back to the drug issue itself, I have a little to disagree with you, Steve, on your basic analysis of the war on drugs and the fact that religious groups just need to do more of the sort of the best defense is a good offense theory, that are, you know, we should address the issues and conditions which lead people to despair or not find life meaningful, and we should try to provide the positive connection. We certainly don't. We do stand in the tradition of the Western or monotheistic religions, and they're not all Western, certainly, but monotheistic religions, that we don't believe altered state of consciousness is what God wants us to do to get in touch with God. That what God wants is our best. Our minds and hearts are working at full, so we don't think we need to take drugs to do that. And so we do oppose drug use for that reason. But so we're not saying, yay, drugs, but we haven't been real hot on the war on drugs either. Well, anyway, that's all I have to say on that one. Does someone want to address something to Steve or me or whoever? Go right ahead, sir.
But then again, my question, okay, given sort of a rational, dispassionate analysis about what's, you know, about where the war on drugs has not taken us, right, in the past 30 years, why I still, like, I don't have an answer. I really want to know, why is it that the churches that have a particular responsibility and a certain kind of stewardship in our society, why is it that the churches have been either disarticulate, silent, or, you know, have been part of the cheerleading squad with regard to the war on drugs? That this particular thing, you know. So are you suggesting? I mean, I want to just follow up with your saying. Are you suggesting that part of the problem is that religious communities have not sufficiently identified themselves as a counterculture, okay? But instead are, you know, are too much identified with and assimilated to the larger culture. Therefore, they can't find a distinctive voice. Right. Okay. Thanks. Oh, yeah. Thanks. Sorry. Sorry about that. Okay. The easiest answer for me to give you is to tell you to read a book by Michael Massig called The Fix, and it's just published this year. And what Massig did was to look at the history of drug wars in this country and really identified a very, very narrow window that opened up, ironically, or maybe not ironically, in the Nixon administration between 1970 and 1973, where Nixon gave, you know, like a marching orders to some of the people on his staff to find a way to fix the problem. And what they did was, they looked for clinical and therapeutic programs out there somewhere that seemed to be working. And there was a particular program in Chicago that had fantastic results. They brought this guy, you know, to Washington. They started experimenting. Washington D.C. had immediate, you know, positive results. But then Nixon got involved in Watergate scandal, and the whole thing kind of went to pot.
Wait a minute.
Okay, so that's the first thing. I really suggest you take a look at that book. And then there's lots of literature out there. I'm not the expert, okay, about this, but you know, in England, in Scandinavian countries, Western Europe, there are lots and lots of public policies that focus upon treatment and rehabilitation, and not on punition, not on incarceration, and. It's fascinating to me that I think it's two thirds of the people serving time in our prisons and jails are nonviolent offenders, and that many of those who are serving times have been incarcerated for violating laws which in other nations are punished with fines, community service, drug treatment, and in some cases they're not even punished at all. So right now we're in the midst of a massive social experiment, and the experiment is to see whether these harsh, mandatory maximum sentences that are given out to drug offenders, whether they're going to solve the problem. Well, I tend to think that it's not going to solve the problem at all. It's impoverishing our coffers, our treasury. I mean, between, you know, it's $30 billion a year for drug wars, and it's about $35 billion a year for jails and jail building and, you know, personnel and all of that. So it's impoverishing us, and it's also thrusting nonviolent offenders into an incredibly violent culture. And you spend 10 years in a federal prison, and you're probably not going to come out, you know, all full of sweetness and light at the end of it.
Perhaps we could shift gears. Yeah.
And I'd be glad to talk to anybody afterwards. I'd appreciate it, as a matter of fact.
How these two particular presentations got paired together, I'm sure you're both wondering, and so am I, but whatever.
Conflict. And conflict resolution.
Whatever. But that's the way the organizers did it, and so we'll go on and talk now about conflict and how it's handled in religious organizations, as Becky had outlined. Again, I can respond primarily out of my own experience as a part of the Presbyterian Church. And if you recall, the Likert systems 1 through 4 that Becky projected on her last overhead transparency in terms of the various kinds of organizations, 4 that he outlined: authoritative, exploitative kind, benevolent authoritative, consultative, and participative. And she found in her research that, by and large, most of the religious groups she looked at were either consultative or participative, and found that the LDS Church tended to be the benevolent authoritative. I would say that tracks with my experience. I grew up here in the state of Utah. I lived here most of my life. I've been a pastor for 30 years here in this state, and I would say that tracks with my experience, too, in talking to people and my interaction with LDS people. And be an observer of that scene. You know, I think that the LDS Church, I'm just a friendly critic, so I'll just let you know what I think. I think the LDS Church, by the very virtue of the system it has, is pretty much stuck with the way conflict is handled. I mean, you advocate, we ought to have more people, you know, talking openly and being able to express themselves and so on. There's such a respect for authority that no one wants to question anybody. The tendency is to sort of either have loyalty, neglect, or exit, and not a voice. And I think that's true based on my experience. But I say the system's set up, because if the system is authoritative from top down, how are voices from the bottom up going to change the system? That's a very, very difficult thing to have happen. Whereas in our particular system, it's a very centralized system, the LDS Church. I mean, there's no conflict over money, because money goes from the local organization through the tithes that are, and the fast Sunday offerings and so on, that are collected, and they go into Salt Lake City. And now, as I understand it, some of you are LDS members, active LDS members. Would you please tell me the accounting you've gotten recently as to how your gifts have been used? Right, there's no accounting. That's my understanding. Whereas in our particular system, our money's all handled locally. We have a budget that's published locally. Everybody can question it, fight over it. We give a monthly report. Everybody knows where every, don't know who gave what. But in terms of the total, is all given. And we, our Presbyterian Church happens to have a representative democracy type system where we elect elders to act on behalf of the people, kind of like that does on behalf of the United States or the state legislature does on behalf of the people of Utah. But we invite all kinds of comments, and conflict is openly voiced and talked over, and it's primarily handled at the local level by local people over money, programs, activities, whatever, because we have a very decentralized thing. Years ago, our Presbyterian Church USA had our national meeting. We have a national meeting every year, which is a kind of like the Federal Congress for the United States. It met here in Salt Lake City in this very facility before it was all remodeled in 1990. It was interesting that one of the outgrowths of that meeting was that the LDS leadership said, why don't your leaders come over and, well, I happen to be the chair of the local hosting committee, so I was all involved in it up to my neck. And it happened the LDS leaders issued an invitation kind of late in the process of saying, well, why don't you have some of your leaders come over and talk to us, kind of have a punch of cookies, so to speak. Kind of like what Mr. Bush did when he was in the territory here recently, raising money and so on. And our denominational leaders declined to do that because, quite frankly, they when the General Assembly's in session, they go from about 5 a.m. to midnight every day. And it's like having the federal government be here in Salt Lake City for 10 days. And that's the way, well, like our denominational headquarters moving here for 10 days. So they said, man, we're so busy, we don't have time to do that. But we want to talk. And it's very interesting so we did. We did facilitate a communication. One of the first quorum of the 70 people stopped by our headquarters in Louisville, Kentucky. And our church invited me to be a part of that discussion. And there was the first quorum of the 70 guy plus a staff member. And me were all outsiders there in terms of not. But it was very interesting for the LDS people to come into our headquarters, which our national headquarters has about 650 people that work there. It's a three-story converted warehouse. Compare the headquarters here. 20-some story buildings here and there all over the place, very highly centralized. Those two things just symbolize the difference of the organizations and how they operate and how they handle conflict. I have nothing else to say at this point.
Where are you planning to publish
this? Well, let me just say, the question is, where is she planning to publish this?
Thank you. You know, I hadn't really got that far. I'd like to do some more data gathering before I really get to the publication stage, but I hadn't really thought about it, to tell you the truth. I just think it's interesting, but I haven't gone any farther than that. The question is, if I was a consultant to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, what would I tell President Hinckley regarding conflict resolution? Right, it's a dream. There's no doubt about it. First of all, as Reverend Silliman says, it's such a systemic problem. It's endemic in the whole system. I'm not sure I can say, fix this little thing and fix this little thing and fix this little thing and you'll have much better conflict resolution methods and you'll be happier and everything will go well. I don't think that would necessarily happen. What I can say to him is, do you have people leaving the church? Do you have disaffected members? Do you have people who have problems? Do you have people who don't pay their tithing? Do you have bishops who become disillusioned with the system? Maybe that has something to do with the conflict resolution methods that are presently used. And the way that we're teaching, I think, people in the church to resolve conflicts with one another, which is generally to exit or to stay in the relationship but not to do anything about the conflict, or to pretend there isn't a conflict. These are not very healthy ways of dealing with conflict. And it's not going to be a very healthy environment, a healthy climate for the church of Jesus Christ to have that kind of system built into it. But how are you going to fix it? I think it takes major changes, big changes. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. The personal conflict style theory that I talked about, exit, loyalty, neglect, and voice, is a personal theory that really details how people react to each other. The question is there an effort been made to apply this kind of research on conflict resolution to the family or to interpersonal relationships? In education, yes. Outside of education, I don't know for sure. Because I'm in education, so I teach these things to my students, so I can say that, yes, they should become familiar with them, and they should become then a part of the repertoire of their new behaviors in terms of dealing with other people. But do they hear it anywhere else? I don't know about that. I really don't know. I don't think so.
Could I make a comment at this point? It's my observation that, for example, Brigham Young University has one of the best family systems marital therapy programs on a doctoral level in the country, right at top two or three. And so I think there's a fair amount done there in terms of doing remedial conflict resolution and teaching therapists how to function there. I happen to know several who we used to employ, one who got her PhD at our church, got her PhD at BYU, and I know a lot about that from that standpoint. But my observation is there's not much preventive stuff going on in terms of system-wide educational kind of things.
Point.
You didn't mention the RLDS Church in your collection of the people's groups that you serve in.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a member of the RLDS Church here in this session right now? I appreciate knowing how conflict resolution is handled in that